I'm Robert Siegel on Capitol Hill, where opening statements in the case to remove President Clinton entered the second day.
The Sergeant-at-Arms will make the proclamation.
And this day two was uncannily reminiscent of day one.
All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the Senate of the United States is sitting for the trial of the articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives against William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States.
Not only were the formalities the same, the Sergeant-at-Arms proclaiming, the Chief Justice presiding, but the substance was the same. Representative Bill McCollum, a Florida Republican, made today's first statement in which he summarized and then detailed precisely what had been stated on Thursday, the case that President Clinton lied and, in fact, perjured himself when he denied a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
If you believe the testimony of Monica Lewinsky, you cannot believe the president or accept the argument of his lawyers. You simply can't. The record is so clear on this that if you have any significant doubt about Monica Lewinsky's credibility or her testimony, you should bring her in here and let us examine her face to face so you can judge her credibility for yourself.
This, too, was an echo of yesterday's opening statements. The appeal to senators to call witnesses to the well of the Senate, not just to take depositions from them, but to hear and see them testify live. That issue remains very contentious between Republican and Democratic senators. And then a sore point with the president's lawyers. Congressman McCollum argued that even though the House of Representatives failed to approve an article of impeachment charging perjury in the Paula Jones lawsuit, the second article that did pass, charging obstruction of justice, covers lies the president made in his deposition in that civil suit.
It should be pointed out that lies under oath in a court proceeding, whether or not they rise to the level of crimes of perjury, can be obstruction of justice. So when the president lied in the Jones deposition, this was part of the obstruction of justice charged under Article 2 that's before you today, even though there is no separate count. And he lied a lot in that deposition. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The fact that the House did not send you the article of impeachment for perjury in the Jones deposition does not keep you from considering the lies in that deposition as an obstruction of justice crime under Article 2 that's before you.
Don't lose sight of the totality of the president's scheme to conceal and cover up, McCollum said, a scheme which, in his view, was carefully plotted, not just a series of impulsive acts driven by embarrassment. And House Manager George Geekus of Pennsylvania argued, as did his colleagues before him, that this alleged scheme was not victimless, but rather it deprived its victim, Paula Jones, of her right to bring a sexual harassment lawsuit.
If someone, a member of your family, or someone who is a witness to these proceedings, had a serious case in which one's self, one's property, one's family has been severely damaged, would you suffer without a whimper perjurious testimony given against you, which you know down deep that at the end of the day has caused you to lose your chance at retribution, at a chance to be compensated for damages, to restore your family life? Isn't that what our system is all about? Isn't that what the adverse consequence is of the attempt to obliterate the Paula Jones civil suit? That's what it is. Not he committed perjury, so what? It is what the end result of that perjury might be that you should weigh.
Many senators, including Democrats, have praised the opening statements they've heard for their thoroughness. And while that sentiment is no doubt sincerely held by many, it's also an expression of a self-conscious effort at civility. Democratic Senators Daschle and Kennedy both praised the manager's work during a news conference in which they were trying to talk about HMO reform. Asked about the president's situation, Senator Daschle said Mr. Clinton, like every American, is entitled to good HMO coverage. Senator Kennedy suggested waiting until the president's response is over before addressing the need for live witnesses. Well, that need is increasingly being felt and expressed by Republican senators like Susan Collins of Maine.
As a juror, I don't know how I can resolve those issues without hearing from live witnesses. In addition, it strikes me as only fair to the president for his attorneys to be given the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses who have offered testimony that is detrimental to his interests. So to me, it promotes fairness to have witnesses.
But Democrat Charles Schumer of New York, who in the last Congress sat on the House Judiciary Committee and argued there against impeachment, says the evidence raised in this week's opening statements are beside the point. The real issue for him is whether the offenses described, perhaps even being proved by the prosecutors, amount to grounds for impeachment.
The most difficult part of the case that they can make, that they have to make, is that even assuming the facts, high crimes and misdemeanors indicate that the president should be removed from office. That is their great difficulty. They'd love us to get into a little factual dispute here and then say, well, that's why we need witnesses. But I've always worked on the view, even assuming their facts are right, they still have another burden to reach. And if they haven't met that burden to go through witnesses and go through a trial, it doesn't make any sense.
And that case, the case that the charges against the president amount to impeachable offenses, is what the House managers intend to make tomorrow in their unusual Saturday session before the Senate. Joining us now at the in the rotunda, I should say, of the Russell Senate office building on Capitol Hill are two observers of these proceedings. First, Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University and also a writer for the New Republic magazine. Welcome once again.
Nice to be here.
And David Brooks, senior editor at the Weekly Standard. Welcome, David.
Good to be here.
Again. First, I'd like to ask both of you, and first Jeffrey, about the what seems to be the tactic here of massive redundancy that we sat yesterday through a rather long session, about 6 hours, of hearing the case outlined against the president. I suppose you could say we've heard that outline filled in a bit, but we've heard many, many, many of the same things today. Why?
There was a wonderful cartoon that used to run in the Washington City paper called The Angriest Dog in the World. And in frame after frame, you just had a dog sort of yelling at the top of his lungs without changing his story at all. I think my favorite moment today was George Gikas just driving himself into a lather, saying, that is heavy, that is soul-searching in his quality. So they're very, very angry, and perhaps the notion is that if just the facts are repeated at enough length, then other people will be angry, too.
Is it, I wonder, David Brooks, is it a calculated strategy, or does it reflect the total absence of any calculation?
I guess the latter. It strikes me as sort of a paid advertisement for the American Editors Association, that if they got some editors, they would actually have a very effective case. 3 hours, they could put together a very compelling, tight-set case. As it is, it reminds me, I think there was a Woody Allen or a Andy Warhol movie in the 70s where you paid money to get in, and if you sat through the whole thing, you got your money back. And I think there's some reminiscence to that. The positive side is that it's boring, but it's admirably boring. You know, government is supposed to be a little boring. We don't need great speculative geniuses. We don't need prophetic individuals. We just need trudging plow horsing guys who can go through the facts A, B, C, very straightforward, do their row and get done. And if the White House lawyers are filled with verbal wizardry, you know, doing these half pikes and triple gainers and all that kind of stuff, maybe the sheer dullness of the Republicans will serve them reasonably well.
Jeffrey Rosen?
I have to take a bit of issue with that because I think it's disappointing that the managers are not really engaging the White House's response. We have two briefs and the managers are sticking to theirs surprisingly, but they're really not responding to the powerful arguments on the other side. That's why the arguments that I found most compelling this morning were the ones on the law rather than the facts. The factual narrative has just been laid out ad infinitum, but when Representative Chabot, for example, talked about the law of obstruction and Representative Barr about perjury, at least there was something for the senators to engage, and it's for that reason that I think really the session tomorrow may be the most useful of all.
I'd like to ask you both your thoughts on an idea that's been talked about a lot in the Senate and among the House managers over the past 24 hours, and that would be having President Clinton, either summoning President Clinton or inviting him to come and testify in this trial. It certainly wouldn't be boring, I don't think, if that were the case, but do you think it's likely to happen, and does it make any sense to you? First, David Brooks.
I think it's not likely to happen. I don't think it makes any sense. You know, this is something where the House managers are split amongst themselves, and Henry Hyde, according to reports, has been taking a neutral ground. It seems to me most of the witnesses will be very friendly to President Clinton, none of whom, more so obviously than the president himself, he's very good. He did, you know, in each time this case has switched momentum one way or the other, it's not because one side was so great. It's because the other side was over-arrogant and stretched things a little too far. It seems to me calling President Clinton would be the ultimate example of that.
The ultimate example of the managers of the prosecution stretching things too far and working against them.
It would be a case of just rolling the dice. We've got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the senators will even agree with that. The people up for re-election in the year 2000 will not think they have nothing to lose.
Jeffrey Rosen?
There is an interesting constitutional question about whether or not the president can be subpoenaed. Of course, that was finessed during his grand jury testimony. The independent counsel withdrew the subpoena so that the issue wasn't forced. I think the consensus seems to be that while ordinary courts can't subpoena the president, Congress can. Remember, it was President Nixon's refusal to obey a subpoena by Congress that itself was the most serious impeachable offense during the Nixon era, and that's why prudence, I think, as David suggests, would counsel that this issue not be forced and that if the president is called, he be invited and not commanded.
I'd like to ask you both about a charge, an informal charge against the president. It's not a separate article, but one that Congressman McCollum talked a lot about this morning, and that was witness tampering. He was describing the many aspects of the president's behavior that contribute to obstruction of justice. Did I miss something in the House discussion, or has witness tampering developed a larger life of its own here in the presentation of the case against the president of the Senate? Jeffrey Rosen?
It has indeed. Representative Sensenbrenner yesterday cited a recent circuit case and said that it was directly on point. It isn't really, but it's an interesting debate. In that case, actually, both of the parties knew that the story was false and agreed to spread it. Here, of course, the president's argument is that he was merely denying this affair to avoid embarrassment, not trying to influence the Jones case, but just to avoid telling his wife. This is why the notion of Sidney Blumenthal being called and changing the case entirely because he would reveal this conspiracy to tamper with witnesses, both with Monica and with himself, is so rich legally and factually because, of course, he would claim, again, that he was just trying to avoid embarrassment. It's an open question. The law of witness tampering has been expanding recently, and it's certainly there's plenty for the senators to debate.
Yeah, I wonder, when we see shifts like this, I wonder how much of it is a response to what the senators don't know and what the senators seem to be responding to, either on TV, which they seem to go on every night after the trial, or else just in informal conversations with the House managers after the trial. It's this weird situation where you've got your jury is your focus group, and you can feed back on one another. I think also that, especially the witness tampering with Betty Curry, was proving to be very effective yesterday.
That's David Brooks, senior editor of the Weekly Standard, and our other guest commentator for today, Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University Law School and also the New Republic magazine. They were talking about today's opening statements in the Senate trial of President Clinton.